Why is crypto thriving after SBF? The sports betting crisis is deepening, and Jon Stewart comes out against AI. All that and more is coming up with special guest Zeke Fox right after this.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Welcome to Big Technology Podcast Friday edition, where we break down the news in our cool-headed and nuanced format. We have quite a show for you today. We have Ranjan Roy here. Ranjan is back from France. Ranjan, welcome.
I'm very excited about today. Number Go Up was one of my favorite books of last year.
Yeah, this is another episode that's Ranjan inspired. Ranjan, you kept shouting out Number Go Up on the show. I read it. Definitely one of my favorite books as well. And we're so lucky to have the author here, Zeke Fox, who's the author of Number Go Up. He's also a reporter at Bloomberg. Zeke, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that it's Earthquake Friday here in New York. I know anybody listening to this show is probably over the long media cycle that New Yorkers have had over a manageable 4.8 magnitude earthquake, but I'm not. I mean, we just had the earth shake beneath our feet. Pretty cool stuff.
We should continue talking about it for weeks on end as New Yorkers experiencing that. That's my platform.
We also have some big earth-shaking developments. See what I did there? In the crypto world, including the fact that SBF is going away for 25 years, or at least that's the sentence. It will probably be less than that. Last week, we talked about the sentencing. This week, I want to talk really about the most confusing thing about all this, which is that SBF is gone, a 25-year sentence, yet Bitcoin is up 53% this year. Meme coins are proliferating, and it seems like crypto really hasn't lost a step. In fact, it's gaining. And, you know, Zeke, you have a story out in Bloomberg talking about how the fall of FTX wasn't the exception, or it wasn't just a good company that had some bad decisions. It was rotten to the core, and it's a warning to all of crypto. So with that lens, I want you to explain to us why crypto is having really a banner year when the warning signs are still ever present, and a lot of the problems that led to the downfall of FTX and a legion of other exchanges and banks, you know, they have not been fixed.
One funny detail from that story is that apparently Sam Bankman-Fried has been giving some trading advice to the guards at MDC Brooklyn, the prison where he's been confined since before the trial. And he told them that they should sell Ripple and buy Solana. And if they took his advice, you know, they've probably like doubled their money.
Right. You know, it was excellent trading advice.
Yeah. But so all of crypto is back. But then the flip side is that we learned at this trial that if anything, the FTX scam started really early. They were dipping into the customer fund. He was eyeing the customer funds before he even started the exchange and started dipping into them pretty much right away. And when you talk to crypto traders now, I mean, I've heard this from quite a few people. It's almost like they've dropped the pretense that they're creating the future of finance, that something cool is going on, and totally embraced number go up thinking. You don't hear people talking about DeFi, talking about NFTs. I don't even really get the same chatter from like normal people being excited about crypto, but they're buying just like ever stupider meme coins. And for now, they're all going up. It's truly unbelievable to me. I would be lying if I said I predicted this. But conveniently,
you did, the title of the book your book is called Number Go Up, Zeke. You can't deny credit for what's happening right
take
now.
Take credit. This is your time. That is my favorite part of this entire cycle is that, yeah, exactly. The blockchain is not the key development. As you said, DeFi, it's not DAOs and decentralized communities. It's literally the price is going up and everyone is happy. But
yeah.
What are the mechanics behind here? Yeah. What do you think the mechanics are that are pushing this? If there's no underlying narrative, each previous hype cycle had, you know, a very clear narrative, then what is it?
I would separate it into two categories. And category one is just like gambling is fun. And people love playing the lottery. even though the odds of you winning are like 1 in 300 million. And so people want to play this meme coin game, or not everybody, but just some percentage of people find this game entertaining, and thus it continues. I mean, one funny example of that is this guy, Machi Big Brother. I don't know if he already had the dog or he acquired it for this purpose, but he got like a very cute dog. And then he posted his Solana address and said, like, you know, if you send me money to this address, I'm going to send you some dog tokens. I mean, there was no formal setup. It was just like, here's my address, send money, the dog tokens will come. People sent like $40 million.
Is this Dog with Hat? Because Dog with Hat is my favorite of all the coins.
Oh no, this is like, Dog with Hat is like a blue chip stock. It's kind of boring. People have moved on to like new dog tokens and cat tokens.
I just love the way that journalists have to write about this. So this was on Yahoo Finance. It's talking about Dog with Hat. It says, based on the Solana chain, the token is based on a meme of a dog wearing a pink knitted cap. So it makes sense that the project's headline is that it's literally just a dog with a hat. Despite its simplicity and lack of innovative ideas, the token has performed far better than anyone could have imagined. It began trading in 2024 for just 7 cents, but quickly gained steam. By the end of February, the price surpassed $1. By the end of March, the price broke an all-time high and reached $4.85. A gain of 7,000% in less than 3 months. Dog with Hat, I'm telling you, there's something to it.
Yeah, I mean, so this is just like, it's this sort of, it's like the meme stocks, like GameStop or AMC, and where it's just sort of this fun new game that didn't really exist in markets before, where it's like a pump and dump scheme, but people are doing it to themselves. They're like, let's all buy Dog with Hat. And if enough people buy it, it's going to go up. And I'm going to get out before, I'm going to be one of the lucky ones who gets out before it all collapses. And I was trying to research like the psychology behind this. I was reading a 1936 book by John Maynard Keynes. And he said, he compared the stock market to a game of musical chairs. And said like, hey, people just, it's a game that we can, everyone still enjoys playing it, even knowing that there are going to be like winners and losers. It's kind of like a zero sum game. So I think that explains a lot of the crypto activity. Then you've got Bitcoin, which is a little different, although maybe just sort of a more long-term version of the same thing, where people have sort of given up on this idea that Bitcoin is the future of finance, that it's good for transactions. But people see, you see the price going up, you start to feel like, oh man, wouldn't it be nice if I had some of that in my portfolio? I wish I had something that gained 50% this year. You buy, and that, you know, pushes the price up a little more. And so also addressed by Keynes conveniently, we're all trying to guess, not like, do we think Bitcoin is good, but like, do we think that other people think that Bitcoin is good? Or do we think that we're trying to guess like other people's opinions of this? And lately, everyone's opinions have been, look at the price going up, let's get in on it. And I keep coming back to this idea that in the long run, value has to come from some sort of profitable use case.
Don't be ridiculous, Zeke. Come on.
Number go up.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
I like that we were bringing in Keynesian historical, you know, references. Whereas to me, the more interesting part was the psychological part of essentially a self-inflicted pump and dump. People want to pump and dump onto themselves, but in reality, I mean, that is what meme coin trading is.
There's this is from Molly White this week. She has this amazing story. There is a project promising to rug pull, and it's raised almost $29,000. And this is what she says, a project describing itself as the world's first meme coin pre-announced as a rug pull was explicit in its marketing. Do not buy this coin. It will go to zero. Despite that, people sent the creator over 8.8 ETH, which is $29,000 approximately, during the project's pre-sale. I mean, does it get any dumber than this?
You know, I feel like part of crypto is sort of a competition to come up with the dumbest ideas so that everyone will be like, wow, this one really takes the cake. Let me invest in this one. There's this like kind of nihilistic attitude that dumber is better. And I thought I had always admired the NFT collection Crypto Dick Butts. And do you remember this one?
One of the greats.
Yeah. Yeah. So
oh my goodness.
It was like butts, pixelated butts with penises growing out of them. And I thought, this is the dumbest one ever. I can see why this went to, you know, $5,000. And if I could think of something dumber, maybe I could be a billionaire. But I was never able to think of something dumber than that. But now, yeah, with the dog coins, people have topped it.
Well, and here's my theory on this is do you believe there is something more sophisticated? I don't want to use the word nefarious behind all of this, in the sense that one of the things that always I remember when Beeple sold the, I think it was $64 million digital art, it was essentially kind of like crypto NFT promoters who were buying that using crypto given gains. And then they were going to, like going on, once they create that hype cycle, to sell other tokens, try to make more money on top of it. So the initial ridiculousness, you know, the same way with the rug pull, maybe is the idea, put a little money, you put 8 ETH in the dumbest thing out there. And then the thing you're selling to the market is actually not that dumb as, you know, the rug pull token. Like, are there sophisticated ideas behind crypto dick butt and the project rug pull?
That might be the best question ever asked on this podcast.
I did it with a serious voice too. So
I don't want to accuse Mr. Rugpull of anything, but I'm just going to throw this out there as a possibility of something that a scheme that one could do. I mean, I could announce, let's say we all teamed up, I could announce Rugpull token, and we're all working together. And then you guys could send me, you know, 7 ETH, and then the internet would see this and be like, oh, looks like Rugpull token's really taking off. It's collected 7 ETH. Somebody else sends me 1 ETH, and we just made, I mean, it's very easy to make these tokens. We just made, you know, a 1 ETH profit. We could split it 3 ways. So like the people who are organizing these coins, it would not be difficult for them to rig it so that they were going to profit no matter what happened. I'm not saying that they all are, but like when you come in and like you're sending some money in because you think it's funny on the internet, like the odds are against you. The insiders, there's at least like a possibility that they've rigged this in their favor. I mean, they didn't set it up just to laugh. I mean, you never know. Maybe they did, but there's some chance they didn't just set it up to laugh.
First of all, great business idea. We'll be in touch after the show. Second, is there something broader about our society right now where we have, for instance, potentially not given a large portion of society a path to, you know, build wealth? Like last week on the show, Reid Albergati and I were joking about like, you know, how difficult it is to build retirement savings. And is it that we've just created such a desperate moment in society that people decide that they need to go this route? I mean, there was a story that I read recently about people taking their student loans and putting them into sports betting. It's insane. But is there a broader commentary that we should be thinking about here when we talk about all of this insanity?
I totally think you're right. And I once had a really interesting conversation with a closet salesman at IKEA. And like, I chat everybody up about crypto. So we started talking crypto and meme stocks, and he'd lost some money on them. And I was telling him, I hope I wasn't being too obnoxious, but just trust me, this fit in the flow of conversation. I was telling him, you know, I just go with broad market ETFs, and that historically they've gone up, you know, 8 or 10% a year. And I think it's kind of a fool's game to try and beat the market. And he was like, that might be well and good for you, person who's about to drop, you know, $1,000 on a closet. I work here. I don't have any extra money. I need 100x. Like, I'm going to go buy the next crypto token and hope that it helps me get to my financial goals, because 8 or 10% is not doing anything for me.
I'll disagree with both of you here, though. The narrative that, you know, after the financial crisis, people lost faith in traditional, like the banks and infrastructure, and obviously student loan weight, and there are income inequality, and these are things that are clearly, you know, ever present in society. But to me, this is more just a lack of regulation. It's a new type of technology. It's made for betting and it's fun. But again, the idea that people have lost so much hope, how many people really paid attention to 8%, you know, returns over time, annualized, you know, will give me, help me achieve a financial goal? It's always been more fun to bet on crypto dick butt, or whatever the corollary was for time memoriam.
This was true. A family show.
You
up
just
until
weren't
today.
Allowed to bet on crypto dick butt in the past, or you had no easy way to do it.
That's what Warren Buffett said in his most recent annual letter. He was just like, you know, it was mostly about how much money he'd made on crypto dick butts. But then there was like a footnote that
see Warren Buffett in his with his Omaha accent. Yeah, well, crypto dick butts been good to us.
It's been good.
He said it's never been, the casino is in everybody's pocket. It's never been easier, and that may be what's driving this more volatile stock market and also these weird crypto things.
If this is a betting thing, then what do we think about the institutions that are trying to take advantage of the degens or degenerate gamblers who are putting all this money into crypto projects? And, you know, I'm going to point to like where this discussion initiated, where I read your book and I was like, Zeke, why don't you come on the show to help us review Chris Dixon's book, the Andreessen Horowitz venture capitalist who wrote Read, Write, Own, who's been part of the institutional movement to try to get people. You know, it's not just the Bitcoin ETFs that I understand a little bit more, but like to he's been investing in these projects, these Web3 quote unquote projects, which have been effective. Many of them effectively have been rug pulls for the, you know, degenerate gamblers who've gone in. Meanwhile, it seems like Andreessen Horowitz has done quite well.
Yeah, I mean, that book, it was shocking to me that this book was about the promise of Web3, but it did not address the abject failure of so many of the projects that he had invested in. And in Number Go Up, I investigated one of them, the game Axie Infinity. And this was like, if you're not familiar, it was kind of like a Pokemon-ish game where you assembled a team of monsters and battled other monsters. And what made it a crypto game was that you had to buy your monsters and you owned them. That's Web3. And then when you battled, you would earn smooth love potions. And you might say, like, well, why would you want smooth love potions? Well, you need them to buy your monsters. Why do you want the monsters? Well, you can earn smooth love potions. So it turned out that the way they set up the economics of the game, you could essentially earn like a 5 or 10% daily yield in smooth love potions by purchasing these monsters. So people caught on to this and it took off. It was huge in the Philippines. There were like more than 1 million people playing it. And of course, Andreessen Horowitz invested in the company that created this. Their fund has great returns. But what naturally, smooth love potion prices collapsed. Like, this scheme was unsustainable. And I went to the Philippines and talked to people who had, you know, taken out loans, altered their life plans, went into big debt to buy these Axie Infinity monsters, and who were devastated when the price of smooth love potions collapsed. So I think there's probably some argument you could make in favor of Web3, but at least address how this was screwed up. Nobody has said sorry. You know, they keep, nobody's really said like, oh wow, like we really set up the economics wrong. So I did find that surprising that he's, they've invested in some of these, in many failed projects, and he just sort of hasn't changed his story about how Web3 is the future.
Yeah, I think Axie Infinity to me, and actually, I mean, in terms of one of the things Number Go Up, I think, did very well was tell the human stories of the people who lost out. Because again, the only stories we traditionally hear are the people who won for short periods of time in order to get more people interested. But, you know, the stories of, because especially I remember Axie Infinity when it launched, and what really drove the hype was there are these viral videos of people in the Philippines finding economic empowerment through smooth love potion and turning their lives around. And anyone I spoke to in crypto would point directly to that and say, look, we're already changing the world. And then until they weren't. So yeah, and I think that's important.
I might be showing my age here, but I always thought of Axie Infinity as sort of being like the
second
monorail life. Episode of The Simpsons.
Oh, no. Okay.
You know, where a neighboring town is this monorail salesman comes to Springfield and just like gives this whole pitch about how it's going to change the town to get this monorail. And then I think it's Marge goes to investigate, and she goes to this neighboring town that got a monorail, and like the whole town is burned down for some, it's like this wasteland. And to me, Axie Infinity, it's like, this is where you tried your Web3 plan and it totally sucked. You know, it's like a vision of our Web3 future. And so, yeah, if you're still promoting that, you need to tell me why it makes more sense. And another one that, I mean, they were investors in Yuga. I think, didn't they invest in Yuga Labs? Were they invested in Bored Apes, right?
Yeah, $450 million round led by A16Z.
Yeah. So March, like, what were you thinking there, Chris Dixon? What was the logic behind the Bored Ape investment? Now those have become like a total laughingstock.
Well, do you think there's that idea of no one has said sorry? That's something I've thought about a lot, because even Sam Bankman-Fried is heading to prison for 25 years and hasn't really said I'm sorry. But do you think there's needs to be some kind of compunction or recognition of what happened over the last 4 years? Or do you think, I mean, is the strategy, which it looks like it's happening, is to just triple down on this is a future, we're going to make money again on the next cycle?
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty shocked recently. It took me a while to get around to it, but so Coinbase, Brian Armstrong, they've definitely been big on the message of like, it's safe for crypto now, the bad guys are gone, let's get the next cycle going. And they have this new product called Base. It's their level two. And essentially it's very easy to create your own coins that like live on this Base network. And it's got lower transaction fees because it's sort of self-contained, as opposed to like Ethereum, which has gotten very expensive to transact on. So I gave it a try the other day. I went on there to see like, okay, I'm all continually, my expectations are too high. And I'm like, well, if Coinbase is really pushing this, there must be some cool things on Base. And I get on there to trade some like Base coins. And all it is the same. It's like, I guess people associate blue with Base because Coinbase Base is blue. So it's like blue dog with hat, blue cat with hat, blue Elon Musk. Like literally.
This is diversification of your portfolio. Dog with hat, blue dog with hat.
Got to have a little of each, that's for sure. So look, but as we're talking about this, I just want to say, like, is it possible that this has more staying power than we're giving it credit for? Because Zeke, like the core of your book is investigating Tether, which has all sorts of shady things happening beneath it, which you were able to uncover in a real questionable sort of provenance. However, Tether's still at a dollar, right? It's a coin that's just tethered to the US dollar, still at a dollar. None of these shocks have taken it down. Bitcoin is high. I mean, yes, there's going to be this like wacky movement on the fringes, but does the crypto movement have a brighter future than perhaps we're giving it credit for right here?
Yeah. I mean, right now, you know, if you like crypto, you're thinking this guy is so dumb and the market proves it. You know, his book title is dead wrong because it was intended to be a joke. It was not predicting the number would go up. But what I think this isn't like a real technical analysis, but I would think hard about these Bored Apes. You know, why did they, as a sign of what might happen to the whole market, like, for a while, I guess enough people thought they were cool somehow that the price got very high. And now, since they don't do anything and they aren't cool, the price is going down. So while you're out there promoting all these coins, they either have to be like fun and cool or they have to do something. And if they don't meet either of those criteria, I think eventually people will lose interest and they might find something else to do. So I still am very negative on this long term for those reasons. I just think if it's not, it hasn't found like a product that's got mainstream acceptance. Just being gambling games is not enough.
Do you think part of the recent rise of crypto, at least one of my theories, is anytime hype returns to the market, even for a more fundamental reason, it will have trickle down effects to dog whiff hat. And in this case, you know, people saw Nvidia skyrocketing, AI driving the standard stock market. A lot of, and again, you look at the regular stock market, there's not much left in the meme stock way, but, you know, more of the blue chip stocks positioned well to capture generative AI have absolutely blown up well. Do you think it's more the people who didn't get in on Nvidia want to buy dog whiff hat because it's the next thing?
I guess there could be some of that where, yeah, just things were moving around a lot. So we've seen in the past that when risk assets go up, dog coins also go up. So let's buy some dog coins. I mean, I do think there's a risk if you buy the dog coins that you could be the guy who is holding the dog coins when everyone else that remembers that the dog coins don't do anything and there's no need for, they're worthless. But I don't know. It's like GameStop, AMC, those did go down over time. These like memes are not forever.
But I guess what do you think is holding it? Because even Tether, like as Alex said, and reading through your whole book, and for a long time, I've followed the Tether story closely as well. And obviously the absurdity isn't quite crypto dick butt level, but Inspector Gadget creator being part of it or all these other nuances is quite incredible. But again, the idea that every sign points to it should collapse and yet it holds. Like what are the forces that, because in the book, I think you push towards a lot of ideas, but I mean, I think in fairness, don't definitively say what you're thinking of what is actually keeping Tether up. And what is it now?
Since the book has come out, Howard Lutnick, the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald, which is a, you know, respectable New York investment bank, has come out and said, I'm holding most of Tether's money and I've seen the rest. They have the money. And I think barring evidence of some sort of crazy conspiracy, his comments carry a lot of weight with me. And I think that Tether has been helped by rising interest rates. And now, so they're sitting on like $100 billion. That's how many Tether tokens are out there. They don't pay interest. And they haven't invested in treasuries at like 5%. So they're clipping $5 billion in profit a year now. And so if in, let's just say for the sake of argument, Tether had a Sam Bankman Fried sized hole of $8 billion, they could earn that back in a year and a half. Where I come down on it is that there's like clear evidence of a lot of shadiness in Tether's early years, but now it seems to me is that Tether's found widespread acceptance among people doing shady things around the world who are willing to overlook red flags and are willing to hold a dollar coin that doesn't pay interest. You know, whereas in the US you'd be like, why don't I just put this in my, you know, Apple wallet and get 5%?
Zeke, as we round out this segment, I want to talk to you about like one of the like clear negative externalities or uses of Tether, which is pig butchering, which you go into depth and take an amazing trip in your book to a place that was tied directly to these scandals. So love to hear you talk a little bit about that. And then just as a corollary to that, does that relate to all these nudes in bio tweets that we're seeing on Twitter today?
Sure. So if you're not familiar, pig butchering is a scam where someone approaches you either on a dating app, LinkedIn, whatever, a wrong number text is common, and they try to be your friend and they start to drop hints that they're really good at trading crypto. And eventually they get you to download some sort of bootleg crypto app and to send them, usually Tether, to deposit into that app. And they'll even, you can open the app, it looks like you're making money, it seems great, and people start to send in more and more money. Like, I was just at a press conference held by the Brooklyn DA yesterday, where they talked about victims who'd sent hundreds of thousands of dollars. And eventually the scammer will just ghost you and take all the money. And the really dark part of it that I write about in the book is that the people, the scammers themselves, are often victims of human trafficking. And there are these scam compounds in Cambodia, Myanmar, and Laos, which are like evil office parks filled with thousands of people who've been lured there with the offer of like a high-paying job in customer service. They get there, they're trapped, they are tortured, they're beaten, they're forced to send to run these scams, and it's hugely lucrative. It's mostly run by Chinese gangsters. And new research by a professor at UT Austin says that these gangs have collected in the last few years something like $75 billion, mostly using Tether, which is pretty wild. And if you go to, so this doesn't, you know, this obviously doesn't prove anything, but I'd spent like years looking into Tether by this point. The first time I saw Tether in use in the real world was when I was in a border town on the border of Cambodia and Vietnam, one that's known to hold a lot of scam compounds. I get off the bus and right in the parking lot of one of these casinos that is known to be a site for forced labor, there's a little booth that's like, we'll trade your tethers for local currency. And I'm like, I literally don't think I'd seen the Tether logo outside of a crypto conference until I got there. And I'm just like, doesn't prove anything, but kind of a bad sign that this is the place where I actually see crypto in the real world.
That's crazy. And so is that what's going on with these nudes and bio scams on Twitter?
So based on research by John Herman for New York Magazine, he followed some of these scams and...
Wait, sorry, could you guys explain the nudes and bio scam?
Oh, yeah. So there's often on any sort of popular tweet, someone will reply with this tweet in a kind of funny format with a lot of weird like black spaces in it. They'll write like nudes in bio. And they're trying to obviously lure you into clicking. And if you do click through, it takes you to like a very particular fake dating site called Provocative Neighbors, where you can pay to chat with, I guess, like supposedly horny singles who are actually gig workers who get paid on commission. So it's kind of similar to the pig butchering model, but I've yet to meet anyone who's escaped from a scam compound who had to work on these nudes in bio replies. So that they may be fully voluntary.
This is more traditional catfishing than something more sinister.
And I think it just shows, so I once spent a while researching the shady side of affiliate marketing. And there's always been these guys who they will buy up ads on like porn sites and direct people into these kind of low and scams. They call them like dating sites, but it's not real dating. And I think what happened is that Twitter has such bad content moderation and is getting really low prices for its ads now. So it's getting like these porn site quality ads that used to be screened out by better moderation or right, just higher prices for their ad
inventory.
They're
not just ads though. Like they just show up like in the replies as like bots. And I mean,
it
could all
be
true.
Which Elon Musk was going to save us from the bots on Twitter.
Yeah. But okay, one last thing about this and then we'll go to break. It's what's interesting I also read in the Herman story is that like this is just sort of like the tip of the iceberg when it comes to OnlyFans agencies. So there are companies that run, this is what he says, there are companies that run OnlyFans accounts that are staffed and they talk simultaneously with dozens of users who are led to believe they are talking with real models, not male operators in, say, Poland. And there's a quote, every guy has three monitors, three chats at a time.
Oh, wow.
It's just sad. So
before we go, I just wanted to ask one thing, because again, from reading the book, there's one thing that I kept thinking about going back to pig butchering. It's almost rare you have a scam where both sides of the scam are victims. And then, you know, there's a middleman who's kind of controlling it versus usually you have the very clear scammer and the scammy. But here's something that's so awful where you have people losing their money on the being scammed side and then literal human trafficking to help drive these scams. And obviously, like, why is this not more of a story? And I've seen, I think John Oliver did a segment. I've started to see it some more coming out. But, you know, there's some stories when I read them after reading your book, all I can think about is why are more people not talking about this or why hasn't this gotten more attention? And I'm assuming you want more people to read your book and that would be step one. But in general, like, is there something to this story that prevents people from just, you know, jumping towards it as this massive thing we need to work together to solve?
From a government perspective, I think it's tricky to solve because the criminals are in other countries where some of these places they operate pretty much with impunity, and the US doesn't have any authority there. So what people, activists, are doing is trying to work with law enforcement in those countries to push for more raids of scam compounds, for them to stop, you know, looking the other way, and to make it into sort of an embarrassment so they can't, like in Cambodia, it became kind of like a national embarrassment, which led to at least some raids, although they continue to operate in Cambodia. But from a law enforcement side here, somebody comes to them and they say, hey, I lost $1 million to pig butchering. And if you're lucky enough to find, first of all, a lot of police officers don't know about this. So they might not understand what happened or how they might be able to help. Even if they are savvy, the money is long gone. And that's why crypto is so great for these scams. Because like if you're a crypto person, you're like, come on, it's not crypto's fault. But the thing is if you if you send some Tether to someone who you think is a pretty girl but is actually a victim of human trafficking in Cambodia, you zap them a million tethers, that money is gone. And you don't have any clues. You don't have any address or any name. It used to be like for a Nigerian email scam, they would often work with money mules in the US who would let the con men use their bank accounts. So that would at least give law enforcement something to go off of. And also, like, I mean, some of these pig butchering scams do use bank wires too, but you're going to set off a lot of alarms at the bank. You're going to get a lot of warnings. But yeah, honestly, I'm surprised that people haven't tried to do more to stop this too. It's really like, it's really massive in dollar amount in terms of the amount that Americans and people in other countries are losing. And the United Nations has called it possibly the biggest human trafficking operation in history. They estimate 200,000 people are trapped in scam compounds.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So I would say people should work on figuring out how to solve this. And I would, it's another place where I would argue that the crypto promoters who are run the coins that the, like if you run Tether and all these criminals are using Tether to do horrible things, you may say like, well, I don't know these people. I didn't mean for this to happen, but it's like, well, they're using your product to do it. So maybe you should try and figure out how to stop them, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So we've talked about gambling with crypto. Let's talk about gambling for real on sports betting. And then, of course, Jon Stewart's stance against AI when we come back from the break right after this.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hi, I'm Tomer Korn, LinkedIn's Chief Product Officer. On my podcast, Building One, we dive deep into what it takes to build great products. Recently, we had Zach Perret, the CEO of Plaid, and he shared about his struggles building a financial app for consumers and how he was able to turn it all around with a critical pivot. Take a listen.
I personally couldn't resonate as much with the consumer set that we were trying to reach. I just didn't have that level of empathy. When we made the shift to building a B2B product though, I was building the product that I wanted. My co-founder and I were creating the product that we wanted ourselves, and we had so much empathy for what that product was.
Such a great insight.
You know, in that sense, we got lucky because we were creating a thing for ourselves. And then the people that we were talking to also had the same problems we did. They were fintech developers. We'd been a fintech developer. We'd been trying to build a fintech product for a year. And so we had such deep empathy. We had such a clear ability to...
If you want to hear more of Zach Perret's story and the lessons that follow, listen and subscribe to my podcast, Building One.
And we're back here on Big Technology Podcast with Zeke Fox. He's the author of Number Go Up. It's going up, but he wasn't predicting that. So he tells us, or maybe he was. It's a mystery. We'll leave it for you to decide. And Ranjan Roy is also here, Ranjan of Margins. So Ranjan, first of all, welcome back. Ranjan, you and I have been texting about sports betting, and I've sort of been like, this is a growing disaster. We have this NBA player, Jontay Porter, who made some like really suspicious prop bets about his output on the court and hit, and well, sorry, we don't know if he made them, but we do know somebody who made some of these bets, hit on every one of them, and was like a big winner. On DraftKings or whatever it is, whatever sports betting platform it is. It seems like it's corrupting sports, and it seems like it's also turning people into serious gamblers that might not have been otherwise. What's your perspective on it?
All right. When I think about sports betting in the United States, I have to compartmentalize myself because on one hand, I agree. I think it's going to really have a negative impact on especially college sports or lesser compensated sports. And it's going to cause a lot of problem for, you know, addictive behavior. On the other side, I love it. I absolutely love betting on sports. And in a way, I am very controlled on it. You know, I literally can get a tremendous amount of joy on putting $5 on a random NBA game that happens to be televised and keeping it on my TV on like a random Tuesday night and just having the time of my life. So it doesn't even need to be big money, $5-$10 here and there, and it's great. So I gamble on sports very regularly, and it provides me a great deal of entertainment. But I do think, like, for college sports, and I was also another thing that I was reading in The Athletic, that there was an athlete, and this stuff, I mean, I will myself yell at the screen, where he took a last-minute three, and they were already they're up by 25 points. It put them up by 28. The line was 27.5. And he started getting death threats. And, you know, this is like some like Division I game, middle of the season, up by 27, takes a random three, just kind of heaves it up at the end. It happens to hit, and they get death threats. So the amount of weird behaviors and problematic behaviors this is, you know, generating on every side is a reminder that, to me, the problem is, when these things come at full force with absolutely, it went from completely illegal in the majority of the country to very legal in a lot of the country, and tons of TV advertisements, tons of apps available, whether you want DraftKings or Caesars or what a FanDuel or whatever else. I think the speed at which it came and the ferocity with which the marketing comes with it, that's the problem here.
Do you know how it happened, by the way?
No, I've never.
Why it happened so fast? I did some research. It's an amazing story. And it all comes down to Chris Christie. So this is from some AP reports, and a combination of AP and the New York Times. Yes, it really is a Chris Christie thing. In 2012, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie signed legislation authorizing sports betting in the state. It was seen as a way to attract more visitors and gamblers to help revitalize Atlantic City and generate tax revenue for New Jersey's budget. Then the leagues sued him. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court made it constitutional everywhere, allowing states to make their own rules, right? So the Supreme Court made that ruling in 2018. And then now there's 40 states that allow sports betting. And that's why it's exploded. So it all comes down to this initial, move by Chris Christie to revitalize Atlantic City, which I just visited for the first time and had a lovely time out there. And I see Zeke reacting with indignation, so I'll turn the floor to him.
Well, I think like sports betting is one of those things where it's really gambling in general. It's really well established that most people can like enjoy gambling and can do it without ruining their lives. But there's some percentage of people who will gamble compulsively and where this is really, really harmful to them. And so by expanding the universe of gamblers, we're creating more people who are going to be these big losers who are going to hurt themselves. And you can say everyone should be allowed to do what they want, but is it really desirable to let everyone have access to this like in their pocket? You know, like is the good that we're creating for society by helping other, you know, somebody like you have more fun outweighed by the small percentage of people who are going to have like serious negative consequences? And I would say like, maybe yes, you know, don't. And it's also kind of gross to just, let's like just watch sports and not talk about betting lines the whole time.
Such a
good
point.
Kind of ruins it for me.
Because that's I think the big problem here. It's not just that fact that it's become legal. It's the fact that leagues have so integrated it. And media, by the way, not getting off the hook here, have so integrated it into the experience. You're like, watch a game and you see the line. You have gambling shows on, you know, networks, for instance, like ESPN, et cetera, et cetera. It used to be announcers would never talk about the line, would never talk about a team covering. And now it's everywhere. And that popularizes it to the point where you feel like you're not really part of the sport if you're not betting on it. And that's really the issue. And you're right. It's led to some crazy stuff. We even have this, there was this Cavaliers coach, Cleveland Cavaliers coach, JB Bickerstaff, talking about what the gamblers are doing, you know, again, because of like, you know, the line and trying to make sure that they hit on their bets. He says, they got my telephone number and were sending me crazy messages about where I live and my kids and all that stuff. It's a dangerous game. And he says it right here, in a fine line that we're walking for sure. And you look at what's happened in the Major League Baseball with Shohei Ohtani, the game's biggest star and a star in a game that really needs stars, being involved in this with his interpreter. We still don't know the extent of that. And it is going to spiral where you have, you know, of course, players are going to be involved. We know that. And the leagues are going to really harm some people's lives by pushing this stuff so hard.
Well, I want to say that I say this kind of hypocritically because I don't really gamble anymore, but I have enjoyed. I wanted to bet on the Mayweather-De La Hoya fight so bad that I took, you know, $1,000 to Western Union and sent it to some online casino in Jamaica.
As long as you don't send Tether to some lover out there, it's much better.
Western Union was the original Tether, I feel. But.
Yeah, I kind of, yeah. It's another example where it's like, do you really want to make this easier. Like maybe a little friction was good for society.
Exactly.
But I think that's the right point, that friction is the most important thing. I mean, and again, in terms of the amount of energy with which the leagues are integrating themselves into this, because even from a media standpoint, I forget who it was, but I think one of the prominent ESPN journalists started his own sports gambling media site account or whatever. And I don't know, do you guys remember in the early days, by I think what's that, a year and a half, 2 years ago, of it being legalized in New York, New Jersey, there were just viral tweets of people who like hit a parlay that they bet like $25 and won $2 million. And it would all be pushed by this one person who had just went over to start a sports media gambling media empire.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, and it was so obvious. Like, and to me, the corollary with crypto is so clear, where it's like, you have to tell that story of winning. You have to make it go viral and everyone else will rush in. And again, like that's where, if you, even the UX of one of these apps, like it's not encouraging you to put $10 on a, you know, like a 51-49 bet. Everything is about the parlay because they know the promise is high, but you will likely lose, and that's where they make their money.
Before I knew Sam Bankman-Fried was running any sort of fraud, when I was down with him in the Bahamas when things were going great, this is what I was like, Sam, you're essentially, these ads you take out promoting FTX with like Tom Brady and Larry David, you are promoting gambling. And like you yourself say that it's even worse because a lot of the crypto coins on your exchange, you yourself say are probably fraudulent and going to zero. So this is, you're promoting something that's just gonna lose money for most people. Isn't this inconsistent with your, you know, effective altruism mission? Yeah. And he never really had a good answer for that. Maybe because he was too busy covering up his massive fraud.
Exactly.
It takes a lot of time.
Now
it takes a lot of effort.
So we have a few minutes left here. I think we should talk. I'll just to wrap up this segment. This is a huge story, the sports betting story. And I think we're just at the very beginning. And it is in its early years and it will get worse. And there's going to be some massive scandals and the leagues and state governments are going to have to reckon with it. And we do have some late breaking news that Louisiana is going to ban prop bets for college players starting this summer. So I expect more of this to hit, and that might have reverberations for these betting apps like DraftKings. And actually, maybe it will send more money into crypto, because if people hit restrictions with sports betting, they're going to just want to get more dug with hat. So now, speaking with this, about this Jon Stewart thing, I thought it was really interesting that Jon Stewart went after AI in his segment on Monday. He made a really good point, right? And that was that there are all these people out there, all these tech executives out there promoting AI's benefits and saying that AI is going to help save the world. Meanwhile, on the other side of their mouth, they're talking about how it's going to reduce the need for labor. And he basically hammered home this inconsistency, saying you're talking about how AI is going to help cure disease. Meanwhile, what you're actually doing is inventing labor replacing technology. Now, I've been on record about how I think that the labor fears are a little bit overblown, but recently I've started to think, actually, you know, this is going to be something that displaces a bunch of jobs. Stewart was not nuanced about this, right? He didn't talk about the fact that there was actually going to be a lot of good that comes from AI. He basically discounted that, but I thought it was a good point. And I'm curious what you guys think about it.
Jon Stewart, I'm very excited for his return away from Apple, which I didn't really watch him. I was a huge fan through the 2000s and of The Daily Show. I love listening to him still on politics and more societal commentary. But when he talks about tech, the episode with Lina Khan, I did not love. Like, he was trying to make jokes about the wrong things or trying to, you know, bring too much light to what I think antitrust and monopoly is a serious issue. And even on AI, when I'm listening, like, yes, every CEO who's in an earnings call trying to say how AI is going to increase productivity and cut jobs, that's what they are supposed to say, essentially. And that's just the way, you know, the stock market will value things and investors will look at things. So I think trying to use that to try to make an argument about the actual implications around job loss does not make sense. And as you said, the question of impact on labor, is an important one and is an interesting one. But I think this was one of those examples where when it comes to tech, I a lot of the time do feel Stuart oversimplifies things.
Like on the face of it, to me, it's sort of impossible to imagine that AI would not lead to big job loss. But in the past, when there have been innovations that have replaced certain classes of workers, we've found newer and more productive things to do. So could this be like the one time that it's different? Like, it sort of seems like maybe yes, but I also, it always seemed that way in the past too, when there have been the like scary new innovations.
Stuart's argument here is that this is going to happen faster, that in like, for instance, take the Industrial Revolution, that happened over dozens or more than 100 years, whereas AI, he says, is something like coming Thursday. What do you guys think about the speed of this?
That's again, like for anyone, and we've on this show talked about this a lot, like for all the talk and the hype and the toy like use cases, for anyone really trying to operationalize this for work purposes, we're still a long ways away.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, again, for all the talk, for like, and using it in your job in different ways, people are starting to understand and acclimate things and come up with different, you know, like halfway use cases, but the complete replacement and automation where there, I don't know. I think there's still, it's not coming Thursday, maybe not 100 years, but it's going to be in the years at least, especially if there's not some huge pushback because those benefits and gains aren't seen in the next 6 months like everyone's promising us.
I mean, I've been playing around with this one app that I think shows kind of a paradox about AI. It's kind of a silly one called Suno. It can, you give it a little one sentence prompt and it'll make a song for you.
And oh, right. Yeah.
It's like, it's kind of amazing. Like, I told it to write a song, like a country song about my daughter and her friend going to the movies. And it did. And it sounds kind of like a real song. And my daughter was kind of amazed by it. But then the song is kind of also like the most terrible song ever. And no one has asked to listen to it again. And even my six-year-old daughter has not expressed any interest in playing with this app anymore. And I think there's like one version where in like a couple of years, this app becomes amazing and we do want to use it. And it is like displacing real artists. And there's another version where somehow we sort of plateau in this uncanny valley where it's like this really cool trick, but it is sort of useless for the types of things that we want.
I'm so glad you brought up this. My favorite discovery of the week was Sonauto. Sonauto.ai, also a music creation app, and had the same exact experience. Really cool, fun, making novel songs about really stupid, funny things. And then you listen to them once and it's fun and then you move on. But it's not, some of them, but again, there's glimmers of genius almost where you're like, wait, if it could do that and make the entire song that good, this is amazing. But which way this is going to go? Yeah, I don't think it's guaranteed that it gets better and better and better and better every single day at a scale that we've never seen.
I'm a little surprised that there hasn't been some like groundbreaking AI created art that's going to get all of our attention. I mean, it seems like there'd be a lot of interest in like the first AI this or the first AI that. And so there'd be like some incentive to be the one to create it. And yet, I don't know, maybe I missed something, but I haven't seen this like thing that has people saying, oh my God, I can't believe like AI did that, other than like these little demos.
So John Stewart, for all his faults, he's been good at tapping into the nerve of in the vibe in the country. And it's, I find it just interesting that he's come out against AI, and I haven't really seen an overt AI backlash yet, at least. So do you think there's something under the surface there that he's seeing and that potentially we're missing? Or do you think this is just a misfire on his part?
I would say like among like regular people that I talk to, they are pretty down on AI and think more about kind of the annoying spammy aspects of it than, you know, the potential for helping make new advances in medicine or things like that. So I think he's not he's tapping into like the mainstream sentiment there.
Zeke, how many of your friends have fallen for the nudes and bio scam, and are these the ones that hate AI?
And that have come forward and are ready to be named to the world. I think, first of all, and John Stewart, I wouldn't even say all his faults. I still think overall, like, you know, he's still a force in the media. But I agree. I do think he's tapping into something. I just don't think this specific topic he did well, in my opinion. But he totally is tapping into something, because if you think about it, you know, the Taylor Swift deepfakes on Twitter, these are the things that are going to be much more present in the conversation. Again, as Zeke said, as, you know, like the like breaking down of protein structures via AlphaFold and the rewriting of medicine or whatever it is, like no one's going to talk about that. So especially in the election year, you're right, it hasn't been a debate or a topic yet, but maybe it could be. And if so, who comes out on which side?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, him jumping into the fray, I think, is a signal.
Oh, John Stewart? Yeah. No, but Trump, Biden, who's pro, who's anti-AI?
I think you got to be pro-American innovation, right? I think they both go pro-AI.
Yeah, that's what makes this one complicated, the American innovation side.
Maybe there's a third-party candidate that comes out anti-AI and ends up winning because of that, like... RFK.
Could RFK,
yeah, RFK, but yeah,
that would threaten his support from the All In podcast.
That would be really rough
his
for him.
Crucial backing. Yeah.
He's going to turn on them. That's the heel turn. He goes anti AI come October.
I mean, AlphaFold is laying the groundwork for lots of vaccine development. So you would think that RFK Jr. would be reflexively anti AI.
Oh.
Just I think we're saying.
Nobody tell him that.
Okay. The book is called Number Go Up. It's by Zeke Fox. You can get it in any bookstore of choice. A favorite of Ron, John, and I's. We'll be talking about it on the show for quite some time. And so great to have you join us, Zeke. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
Super fun. And Ron, John, welcome back. Thanks for being here with us.
This was fun. I'll see you next
week. Great stuff. Ron, John, and I one-on-one for the first time in a month coming up next Friday. In the meantime, I'll have Jack Clark, a co-founder of Anthropic, joining me for an in-depth episode on what Anthropic is up to on Wednesday. So until then, we'll see you next time on Big Technology Podcast.